The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Let's go ahead and get started. I appreciate you all coming out here. This is a time of day and time of week where we should actually be going to the golf course, as far as I'm concerned. But you all are apparently tough and ready for more, so we'll do that. This talk I've titled Trapped in Our Culture, and I was just telling Chris Schlecht that it's the kind of talk that I think if you talked to three or four people that came out of this, could come out of it, if I'm successful, with three or four very different perspectives on what you took from it. And I think that'll unfold a little bit as we get into it. But let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for what you're doing in our midst. We thank you for the way in which you have worked in our lives, blessed us, and provided for our needs. Father, we are grateful and fearful as we observe things around us, grateful for the work you've given us to do and fearful for the obstacles that we see in front of us. May we now see your wisdom and your hand as we contemplate some of those things. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. I've had the pleasure of being involved in classical Christian education for a long time, by the standards at least of ACCS, since prior to its formation, and have observed some things. My personal circumstances are that I have four boys, the youngest of which just finished his freshman year. For those of you that live in North Carolina, three of them going to state institutions presently in North Carolina, North Carolina School of the Arts, and two at NC State. And I don't get any benefits from that. So if you want to buy me lunch or something for supporting your state, we'll take that. But in any event, some time ago, I don't even remember who encouraged me to read this book, but it was a book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, who also wrote Tipping Point and Blank, if you're familiar with him. Not known to be a Christian, not known to be a Christian thinker, but some very insightful things that I saw in them that I thought were interesting and had some connection to things that I thought good to relate here. The thinking that I want to bring to this is beyond what he writes, but it includes some of the things that he writes. He chronicles well the sociology, and I do mean sociology, of success in this book. That's it if you're interested. We don't sell it, so this is not an ad from Veritas Press by any means. But if you want us a special order, we'll do that. But as we approach our presuppositions and circumstances with our eyes open, I think can help us to avoid and mitigate many limiting factors and even help us create extraordinary opportunities for our students. I'll get into this somewhat, but I've always tried to look, especially with my own children, for opportunities to grease the skids of their interests. And that can be a dangerous thing because students are individuals, and individuals have individual interests, and so you end up going a lot of different directions. There are many obstacles that we need to be prepared in our education, in our schools, to overcome, many more than simply incorporating Latin logic and rhetoric, and of course classical content in our schools. Repairing the ruins requires attention to other matters, some curricular and some not. Now, I want you to think about for a minute. In fact, I'm going to invite some comment if you want to respond. We'll make this a little interactive. I like to leave opportunity for questions at the end of something that I speak on. I don't know how time will work in that compared to the outline, but here's a question I have for you in the middle, or at the beginning. The appeal of classical Christian education. Why are you here? What was the attraction for you? Anybody want to volunteer something there? Yes. Okay, somebody wanted to get away from a bad deal. Good. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yes. After 43 years of teaching, ended up with product that couldn't do it, couldn't think. I think that was an appeal to me too. Okay, anything else? Yes, in the back. Yeah, that was a big thing for me, too. As I read Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, I was particularly drawn to the idea that Christian education is a central necessity to what we do with our children. So as a parent, that was very convicting. I really thought that, you know, we'll send our kids to a really good private school. This is in Orlando, Florida at the time. And at home is where we will inculcate them with covenant thinking and with Christianity, and came to realize from reading Recovering Lost Tools of Learning in particular that was just a fallacious way of thinking. Well, I think I've listed three things here. There are things that are buried behind your outline, so they're not on the outline you've got. So if you want to write these down, these are the ones that I've listed, and they're overlap with things that you just mentioned. To get children a better education than we got. Maybe to get them the best education imaginable. Secondly, to use a method that follows the way God made us to learn, the trivium. I really think that the trivium gives us a description of what it is that describes how we're inclined to learn things. And to connect with and learn from the past so as to avoid making the same mistakes. And then thirdly, to make godly leaders who can tackle anything. Very simply stated, when somebody asks me sometimes, what can one do with a classical Christian education? The answer is anything they want to. And I must say that in many respects, I'm seeing that in my children and in the graduates of kids that I've had some observation of and work with and got a chance to watch. Over some of those years. The idea of this talk came from observations of some limits, though, that I think still hold us back here some, say, 18 years later, at least in my experience. Things that I observe that I think Gladwell's book addresses somewhat. And I should say parenthetically, the term outliers is not a common knowledge term, and he defines it as people who do things out of the ordinary. I'm not sure why he didn't choose in that definition the extraordinary, because I think to some extent that's what he chronicles. And so that's what we're trying to address a little bit here. I should also offer a clarification that success, by Gladwell's definition, is not all we're after. Now, I'm fond of talking about succeeding and success, but in a way that would be biblically wise, not just, or maybe not even, world-wise. So we're talking about that. We are interested in seeing our children, our students, succeed, are we not? Is that not a motivation? I mean, but let's define that term. Let's mean something significant by it. And that's what I want to pursue a bit with you here at this unfortunate hour. I'm sorry. We want a sustainable righteousness that glorifies God by enjoying Him forever and His gifts carried out in our students using theirs. We want to see potential, God-given potential, realized, do we not? We want to see that in the pastorate. We want to see that in the public square. and I don't mean this vainly at all, but God knows we need it. We want to see it in business, where the principles that God has created the world with are used and become commonly applied. I've observed in business, I'm sure there are businessmen here, that it's not sometimes very hard to succeed in business because honesty, a good product for a good price, goes a long way, a lot further than it should. But that's a product, I'm not meaning to equivocate here, but that's a product of the times. That's kind of where we are. And we want to do more than that, but at least doing that is a very important thing. So I've got some more questions. These are not questions that I want answers to now. These are more rhetorical. But I want you to think about them as I go through them. I'll pause, maybe not long enough to formulate an answer, but at least long enough to reflect on its significance. What does a well-behaved boy look like? If you have not dealt with precociousness, obnoxiousness, I'm making up words here, but you get the point, and downright difficulty. In other words, sometimes the answer to that question at a very fundamental practical level is that a well-behaved boy looks like a girl. I'm sorry, but if you're tempted to that by your Snickers, I must inform you that you're wrong. Now, that doesn't mean that we're willing to tolerate and put up with anything, but it does mean that we've got to do some thinking about that because it does create some interesting challenges. My wife knows that. She thinks she's raising 5 boys. How do your worldview and your theology affect your school policies? Now, obviously, I'm contextualizing that in a cultural context more so than a real theological context. But are you prepared to address the nature of kids and what might seem natural and yet might seem uncomfortable in ways that aren't going to be short-sighted for the sake of those kids? Let me unpack that a little bit. How would you like to have participated in, or worse, been responsible for the expulsion of Bill Gates, Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein? Now, I understand that my examples aren't the examples of what we have come to really look for in terms of model students. These aren't, to the best of my experience and knowledge, good biblical worldview folk that would have been particularly comfortable in classical Christian educational circles. But these guys are geniuses. These guys are guys that somebody like you and me got kicked out of a school. And I want to tell you something. We have probably done that with somebody like that because we have not understood them. We have not worked with them. We have not loved them. We have got to realize that our systems, our policies, our ideals sometimes don't fit every circumstance. Now, I'm not suggesting some innovative approach to things like our federal court system, and the Supreme Court in particular, has decided to do with our Constitution sometimes. But what I am saying is we're dealing with people. And we're dealing with complex issues. And we have got to realize what we're really after, what we're really about. What, then, is the ideal culture for a classical Christian education, for a classical Christian school to thrive in? What is it? Well, I can tell you from my observation, experience, and participation that many of the schools have at least tolerance for, if not acceptance of and belief in, the Reformed faith. Now, some of you may not know what I mean by that, and I don't want to go down the road of that because that's not what I'm after here today. But that's a given. But let's consider whether or not that provides some limitations that we shouldn't intend. A very dear friend of mine, I'll not name him for fear of you blaming him. I'll let you blame me for this statement. But a very dear friend of mine observes this about churches. We tend to get about a third of it right. I think he's got some real significant truth in that statement. I don't want you to be involved in leadership of a school that gets about a third of it right. I want to tell you something. You're dealing with the souls of people. You're dealing with serious business. This was pretty exciting in a very interesting and low-level way as we looked at it from a standpoint of what we might be able to do with our second-grade oldest son some nearly, I don't know how many, 15, 16 years ago. But they don't stay impressionable second graders. They become, in the case of that son, 23-year-old businessmen who are going to be, as mother and I hope, married with children. And they're going to be taking with them the baggage, and baggage isn't always negative, but they're going to be carrying the baggage of what you did with them. It's going to be well ingrained in them. It's going to make a difference in their lives. There are some common presuppositions, if you will, that handicap us. One of them might be, this is how they do it in. Fill in the blank. Moscow. Cary. Sorry, Gene and Larry. Lancaster. Who knows where? Models are good. But models don't have perfect overlays anywhere else. You will not be exempted from thinking by taking somebody else's model of a classical Christian school and putting it in your context. You won't even be able to do that as a teacher from one class to another. These are people. They're complex. They're different. Another category of presuppositions that handicap us are we don't have the money. We don't have the people. We don't have the expertise. You're going to need some of the money. You're going to need the people. You're going to need the expertise. If you don't have it, get it. Sorry. I don't have another answer. You don't have replacements for things that are mission critical. They are, by definition, mission critical. You got to have them. I understand limitations. I understand faith. I understand going forward when you don't have it all right. And I am not suggesting that you stop and wait. But what I am suggesting is that you not be foolish enough to think that they're not important. They are. The other thing that those of you who are new to this will quickly discover, and those of you who have been around it more than 10 minutes already know, it's too hard is another thing that will hit you. I want to tell you something. If you are about to start a school, you need to know that you have no idea. We've done it twice. We're stupid, stubborn, or we've seen that it's worth the effort, which is really the case. My wife's correcting me, and she's right. We've done it three times. It is hard work. A friend of mine once said, if you want to know the right thing to do, figure out what the hardest thing to do is, and that's the right thing. Well, that's a little oversimplified, but there's a little nugget of truth in there. Now, I want to give you some notable phenomena. This comes out of Outliers, and what Gladwell does with this book is he talks about, as I mentioned, the sociology of success. He subtitles it The Story of Success, and each chapter deals with a little different context. One of the things that was a particularly profound idea from the book to me was how well he articulated that there is no such thing as a self-made man. Now, we know that at a principled level. He makes it fairly practical. And I'm going to take the liberty to actually read some brief segments of this because he says it better than I can re-say it. The first thing I want to talk about is a chapter he's got in here called the Matthew Effect. Matthew 25:29 is what he is referring to. Probably yanked a little bit out of context, but if you give a little grace to it, I think we can really see how well it does fit. Matthew 25:29 is this: "For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken away." Here's a fact. The overwhelming majority, I think around 80%. Any Canadians here? Good for you. Very proud to be a Canadian. I'm going to put you on the spot. You guys are hockey nuts. Are you a hockey nut? I mean, speaking nationally. More than any other country, about 80% of the highly successful Saki. No. Woo! hockey. I guess the World Cup got me. It's really water, but. About 80% of the highly successful hockey players. I told you it was 3 o'clock. At a certain level, and I think it's Olympic level. I'd have to look again to be specific. We're born in 2 months of the year. Would you like to speculate why that is? Would anybody care to that hasn't read this? Oh, you dog. You read it, and you're going to say, oh, come on. Okay, good for you. I believe that. Anybody care to speculate?
Sure. It wasn't hockey
season. You think like I do, but you're wrong. No, you guys are thinking procreation. Get your minds out of the gutter. That's interesting. It's innovative. It's wrong, but it's innovative. Let me tell you. When they get to be about 9 or 10 years old, they're already playing hockey, probably been playing since they were 18 months. They start to separate kids according to ability for traveling teams. The cutoff date is January 1st. Now think about a kid at 9 or 10 years old compared to somebody that's 11 months younger than him. They're more than 10% older and a lot bigger, stronger, maybe faster. That opportunity continues to be pressed forward because they've been given that opportunity to get better than a kid who hasn't been given that opportunity, and it just continues. What did those kids do to deserve that? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was their circumstance. Well, that's kind of interesting. How does it apply here? I'm not sure. You have to think about it. But it does. In this sense, we're not self-made. Sometimes it's our circumstances. More on that. There is something that he calls the 10,000 hour rule. Who would care to offer a suggestion as to the most popular or greatest rock band of all time? Beatles. Do you know anybody? I'll let you answer this if you want to. Anybody care to speculate? Non-readers of the book. Why they were so great? Yes. Amount of time played. You can expect that. I said 10,000 hour rule, and that makes sense. Let me read something about the Beatles. Here's John Lennon in an interview after the Beatles disband, talking about the band's performances at a Hamburg strip club called the Indra. We got better and got more confidence. We couldn't help it with all the experience playing all night long. It was handy, them being foreign. We had to try even harder, put our heart and soul into it to get ourselves over. In Liverpool, we'd only ever done one-hour sessions, and we just used to do our best numbers, the same ones at every one. In Hamburg, we had to play for 8 hours, so we really had to find a new way of playing. 8 hours? This goes beyond Lennon's quote now. Here's Pete Best, the Beatles drummer at the time. He was before Ringo, for those of you that didn't know. Once the news got out, about that we were making a show, the club started packing them in. We played 7 nights a week. At first, we played almost nonstop till 12:30 when it closed. But as we got better, the crowds stayed till 2 most mornings. 7 days a week? The Beatles ended up traveling to Hamburg 5 times between 1960 and the end of 62. And just to contextualize, 64 was when they first came to America. On the first trip, they played 106 nights, 5 or more hours a night. On their second trip, they played 92 times. On their third trip, they played 48 times for a total of 172 hours on stage. The last 2 Hamburg gigs in November, December of 1962 involved another 90 hours of performing. All told, they performed for 270 nights in just over a year and a half. By the time they had their first burst of success in 1964, in fact, they had performed live an estimated 1,200 times. Do you know how extraordinary that is? Most bands today don't perform 1,200 times in their entire careers. The Hamburg Crucible was one of the things that set the Beatles apart. They were no good on stage when they went there, and they were very good when they came back, Norman went on. They learned not only stamina, they had to learn an enormous amount of numbers, cover versions of everything you can think of, not just rock and roll, a bit of jazz too. They were disciplined on stage at all before that. They weren't disciplined on stage at all before that, but when they came back, they sounded like no one else. It was the making of them. I'm going to give you one other example and then bring this point to summary. This one's about Bill Gates. If you think of Bill Gates as I have thought of Bill Gates, it was kind of right place, right time, had the down and dirty operating system, got IBM to buy it for a piece of the deal every time it was sold, and that was his secret to success. That's not what Gladwell says, and I think it worth noting. Let's now turn to the history of Bill Gates. This is a little bit longer, and I'm sorry for reading this much, but it's actually interesting. I'll try and read fast. For those of you who are Southerners, you're going to have to listen fast. Let's now turn to the history of Bill Gates. His story is almost as well known as the Beatles. Brilliant young math whiz discovers computer programming. drops out of Harvard, starts a little computer company called Microsoft with his friends. Through sheer brilliance and ambition and guts, builds it into the giant of the software industry. That's the broad outline. Let's dig a little bit deeper. Gates' father was a wealthy lawyer in Seattle, and his mother was the daughter of a well-to-do banker. As a child, Bill was precocious and easily bored by his studies. So his parents took him out of the public school and at the beginning of seventh grade sent him to Lakeside, a private school that catered to Seattle's elite families. Midway through Gates' second year at Lakeside, the school started a computer club. The mother's club at school did a rummage sale every year, and there was always the question of what the money would go to, Gates remembers. Some went to the summer program where inner-city kids would come up to the campus. Some of it would go for teachers. That year, they put $3,000 into a computer terminal down in this funny little room that we subsequently took control of. It was kind of an amazing thing. That was a quote from Bill. It was an amazing thing, of course, because this was 1968. Most colleges didn't have computer clubs in the 60s. Even more remarkable was the kind of computer Lakeside bought. The school didn't have its students learn programming by the laborious computer card system. If you're as old as I am, you know what a computer card is, like virtually everyone else was doing in the 60s. Instead, Lakeside installed what was called an ASR-33 teletype, which was a time-sharing terminal with a direct link to a mainframe computer in downtown Seattle. The whole idea of time-sharing only got invented in 1965. Gates continued. Someone was pretty forward-looking. Bill Joy got an extraordinary early opportunity to learn programming on a timeshare system as a freshman in college in 1971. Bill Gates got to do real-time programming as an eighth grader in 1968. From that moment forward, Gates lived in the computer room. He and a number of others began to teach themselves how to use this strange new device. The buying time on the mainframe computer, the ASR was, of course, expensive, even for a wealthy institution like Lakeside, and it was long before the $3,000 put up by the Mother's Club. It wasn't long before the $3,000 put up by the Mother's Club ran out. The parents raised more money, the students spent it. Then a group of programmers at the University of Washington formed an outfit called Computer Center Corporation, or C-Cubed, which leased computer time to local companies. As luck would have it, one of the founders of the firm, Monique Rona, had a son at Lakeside. A year ahead of Gates, with the Lakeside Computer Club, Rona wondered, like to test out the company's software programs on the weekends in exchange for free programming time? Absolutely. After school, Gates took the bus to the C-Cubed offices and programmed long into the evening. C-Cubed eventually went bankrupt. So Gates and his friends began hanging around the computer center at the University of Washington. Before long, they latched onto an outfit called ISI, Information Sciences, Inc., which agreed to let them have free computer time in exchange for working on a piece of software that could be used to automate company payrolls. In 1 7-month period in 1971, Gates and his cohorts ran up 1,575 hours of computer time on the ISI mainframe, which averages out to 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was my obsession, Gates says, of his early high school years. I skipped athletics. I went up there at night. We were programming on weekends. It would be a rare week that we wouldn't get 20 to 30 hours in. There was a period when Paul Allen and I got in trouble for stealing a bunch of passwords and crashing the system. He's my kind of guy. We got kicked out. I didn't get to use the computer the whole summer. This is when I was 15 and 16. Then I found out Paul had found a computer that was free at the University of Washington. They had these machines in the medical center and the physics department. They were on a 24-hour schedule, but with this big slack period, so that between 3 and 6 in the morning, this is the beginning of weird hours for programmers, they never scheduled anything, Gates laughed. I'd leave at night after my bedtime. I could walk up to the University of Washington from my house, or I'd take the bus. That's why I'm always so generous to the University of Washington, because they let me steal so much computer time. Years later, Gates' mother said, "We always wondered why it was so hard for him to get up in the morning." When we see genius and expertise, sometimes we have no idea what went into it. We're talking now about people taking back the arts, being great artists, being great musicians. We want to encourage that. We want to encourage people to be great rhetoricians. Are we providing the opportunities, let alone being willing to allow them the time that they need to do that? I have a particular passion. Those of you that know me know this. I play golf. I try and play golf at a serious amateur level. I know a little bit about what it takes to do those kinds of things. But do you have any idea? I'm a little reluctant to use this because we know what he's been doing with some of his time. What Tiger Woods invested to become the kind of golfer that he did. Are we really willing to facilitate in our children, students or our natural children, that kind of genius, that kind of expertise? Are we prepared to invest in it? Or do we think that too much like that is actually too much? I think we have a problem there. I think we don't really want to appreciate the kind of investment necessary. My friend Doug Wilson, I think he still would say he's doing it, since the early 1970s, has read 2 books a week. Big books. That's an investment. I don't know if Doug still says this, but I remember him one time saying, "What do you do?" Doug says, "What I do is I read." You know, a category of expertise like that is not for everyone. I understand that. I understand being a generalist. I understand not making that kind of investment. But people are making those investments. And if our kids aren't, we will not have the experts in the fields that we say we do. Let's either quit saying it or let's recognize what it takes. Another category, last category that relates to opportunity. I'm going to run out of time. Sorry. I got to move it up here. The ethnic theory of plane crashes. How many of you have seen... everybody's seen these. You've seen these beautiful ads for Korean Air with the teal colors and the grays and the beautiful Korean women and all those kinds of things. Do you realize that that airline has the worst safety history in the history of aviation? Now, that's not really my point, but it is an interesting thing to consider when you consider what marketing can do to us as what we think about an airline. Think about why. Any pilots in here? Sorry, here. I'm a pilot. When you're flying around New York City, the air traffic controllers are generally not the same personality that the ones in Raleigh-Durham are. They're obnoxious. They talk fast. They don't like to repeat themselves. And they're hard to understand, especially for somebody where English is his second language. Korean pilots are typically Korean. They come with a cultural mindset that can be a little bit deferential. They're inclined to defer. And let me tell you something. When you're a pilot, you don't defer to anybody. You listen. You respond, but you, the left seat, are the pilot in command. Some of the accidents that happened with Korean Air, were simply a result of them not doing their jobs because they didn't have a cultural context that made them comfortable defying the circumstances or what they were being told. there's a legacy element that we need to contend with here. We need to think about how that works in our circumstances. One other legacy category. How many of you think that the reason that some of the Eastern population are better at math are because they simply work harder? We've generally thought that. Math in America has been something that we've been slack on. Wilson in Recovering Lost Tools of Learning quotes a study where people think they're good at math when in fact they're not. That kind of thing. There's truth in it. I understand that. But let me read you something else that I think you'll find very interesting. Take a look at the following list of numbers. 4, 8, 5, 3, 9, 7, 6. Read them out loud. I'll read them again. They're not listed twice. 4, 8, 5, 3, 9, 7, 6. Now, look away and spend 20 seconds memorizing that sequence before saying them out loud again. If you speak English, you have about 50% chance of remembering that sequence perfectly. If you're Chinese, though, you're almost certain to get it right every time. Why is that? This is interesting. Because as human beings, we store digits in a memory loop that runs for about 2 seconds. We most easily memorize whatever we can say or read within that 2 second span. And Chinese speakers get that list of numbers, 4, 8, 5, 3, 7, 9, 3, 9, 7, 6, right almost every time because, unlike English, their language allows them to fit all those seven numbers into 2 seconds. That example comes from Stanislaus Dehany, I don't know if I got the name right, book, The Number Sense. As Dehany explains, Chinese numbers, number words are remarkably brief. Most of them can be uttered in less than 1/4 of a second. For instance, 4 is, I don't know if I have this right, C, and 7 is Qui. Their English equivalents, 4, 7, are longer. Pronouncing them takes 1/3 of a second. The memory gap between English and Chinese apparently is entirely due to this difference in length. In languages as diverse as Welsh, Arabic, Chinese, English, and Hebrew, there is a reproducible correlation between the time required to produce numbers in a given language and the memory span of its speakers. In this domain, the prize for efficacy goes to the Cantonese dialect of Chinese, whose brevity grants residents of Hong Kong a rocketing memory span of about 10 digits. That's the end of his quote. The difference means that Asian children learn to count much faster than American children. 4-year-old Chinese children can count on average to 40. American children at that age can count only to 15. And most don't reach 40 until they're 5. By the age of 5, in other words, American children are already a year behind their Asian counterparts in the most fundamental of math skills. Now, I'm not here to discount that there might be other reasons, but I thought that that was a fascinating thing to contemplate and what difference it makes to how we operate with our kids. These aren't things that we're typically thinking about. They're important. They're significant. They make a difference in what you're here for, and we need to be aware of them. So in an attempt to round this out and bring some closure here, as we look at success, as we think about what it means for us to be successful in our endeavors of classical Christian education, we have to realize that in and of itself, it's not a requirement of success. In other words, you don't have to be classically educated to be successful in these standards. But I'll tell you, it does, in a very real way, facilitate success. It is a tool of leverage to the kind of success that we think is worthwhile. It also, I think, makes success more enjoyable, richer. And so we're about something very important. We're about something very significant. You're here for reasons that are very good and very significant. But we've got to be very careful to recognize that it's not a formula-driven endeavor. I've got a couple solutions to suggest. They're not solutions in a final form, but rather in what a friend of mine would call a process. In other words, they give you a starting point rather than an ending point. You need to understand your subculture. We have a little joke in our office. When somebody calls with a southern accent, we're inclined to say, what are the last four digits of your zip code? Because we know the first one's three. A southern culture and a school in a southern culture, an education, a classical Christian education in a southern culture will have some differences than one in Boston or New York City or Southern California. You're going to have to think about what those differences are and to apply them in very real ways. Learn from those with more experience, wisdom, or gray hair. We've got some second generation things going on now. The first generation people did some good work, made some big mistakes. Learn from them. You know that. Probably don't even have to tell you that to know how important it is. But meet and talk with them. Take initiative to do that. Find out what they would do differently. Create individualized opportunities for students that put their education to use. If you want to think in terms of all 20 aim the same direction, going the same way, at least be honest about that with your families. That might be what you do. That might be what you have to do. That might be what you choose to do. I understand that. But do understand that you're dealing with human beings with souls that are individuals, individual giftedness, individual circumstances, individual opportunities. There's been a lot of talk in the time that I've been involved in ACCS and classical education about the problems with egalitarianism. And I think this is a category that we still need to be careful about with regard to that. Creating unique and unusual opportunities can be the difference between somebody really realizing the benefit of their gifts and not realizing it. And finally, maybe that means that you look at something as practical as multiple tracks toward a diploma. Just a thought. I'm done. We have about 10 minutes. Any questions? I can. I'm an opportunist. I think in terms of being opportunistic. I've tried to create in that in my children as well. So when we found out that one of our customers was a very well-known music video director, my son, who's in musical theater and drama, called him. Just wanted to talk to him. Wanted to get to know him. That director, his name's Darren Doan, by the way. If you happen to know him, he directed Collision. You're familiar with Collision, I'm sure. And so he invited us to come see him in Atlantic City, where he was help me out here. What was the name of the guy? He was taping Van Morrison at a concert. Gave us some backstage passes, not far from the home, so we went down there and saw those. He said, by the way, next week I'll be in Chicago taping a Jason Mraz concert. Now, I don't know if our generation, I didn't know who Jason Mraz was, but I actually like his music very much, and you might like it if you don't know it. I would encourage you to consider it. And so he said, you guys want to come to that? Well, I got to go back to work, sorry. But Travis, my son, said, I'll go. So Travis, with his own money, bought a plane ticket, went out there, and Darren put him to work. Darren liked the fact that this kid would do that, and since then has had him out to L.A. to help him do other work, paid work. That's the way things happen when you seize the moment of an opportunity. And it does require maybe some brazenness sometimes. But my experience has been when you show that kind of tenacity and when you show that kind of interest, and when you show a willingness to do something for nothing that others would expect to get paid for, you present yourself in a way that really opens doors up. So as I counsel my own children, as they look at work and careers, my counsel would be, look for whatever you can get in the place that you want to be job-wise and work your way up in it rather than waiting for the right opportunity. In other words, be willing to give before you expect to get what you want. That's probably the principle. Other questions? Yes.
A lot of people might think that these kinds of mindsets are antithetical to responsible planning, especially in the way that a lot of people have been taught to think. How do you find a way to balance this kind of just up and go somewhere on your own money or this seize the day, this carpe diem type of an idea? How do you balance that with also rational, responsible thought?
Well, that's a really good question. The question is, how do you balance responsible planning with impulsive behaviors? Is that fair? I think it's probably true that some people would think I haven't done a very good job of balancing those things. But I do think it's important. I wish I could quote the biblical verse. It's a proverbial, our responsibility is to plan, but it's our plan, but the outcome is the Lord's. And it's that kind of thing that I think comes to bear. As a school administrator, as a board member, as a teacher, we've got to plan things. But let's take it in the context of a classroom. We're here and we've got our lesson plans in place. We've got things that we need to accomplish. And all of a sudden, a rabbit trail opportunity presents itself, and we're faced with a decision. Do we pull them back to the lesson plan, or do we run the rabbit trail? And I think that the responsible answer is that we were prepared for it already by having budgeted some rabbit trail time. Okay? So the planning process involves some unknowns that we budget for. That's just one answer in one small category. You guys are going to have to put the principles in other places and times and circumstances. You mean online? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we've got it. My wife corrected me earlier about the fact that we've been involved in starting three schools. The third one is Veritas Press Scholars Academy, which operates online only. We have a circumstance, I think they live in Georgia, where we were presented with a 15-year-old girl who has been invited into a high school program at Juilliard for prima ballerinas. She's the real deal. She's working her 10,000-hour deal. And they needed a circumstance that was above the norm. She needed to be in a particular class in our online thing so that she could get, while she studies to be a prima ballerina, she could get an honors diploma. So she's not taking this minimalistic educational approach. She's going into a classical education environment and getting an above average diploma, an honors diploma. And she needed a class that was full. We don't make exceptions for full classes. So what do we do? Our answer is, well, first of all, their answer was, we will pay. Now, they had the resources to do it. I understand that that's not the case in every instance. We will pay the transfer fee and tuition for anybody in the class that we need to be in if they will simply take the class at a different time. All we needed to do was facilitate that by asking the people in that class if there was anybody willing to do that. I don't know the status of it at this point, but that's the kind of thing that requires a little bit of effort to help somebody do the kinds of things that are using the gifts that God's given them. And I think it's a good thing for us to operate with that mentality. After all, if you're willing to start a school, you ought to be willing to work a little bit more in those categories that might prove beneficial to you long term. If you look at it just selfishly, it's worth it, let alone what you're doing for somebody else. One last question. Thank you very much.